Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
The frenzy and uncertainty surrounding disease epidemics has social consequences, and some treatment and prevention techniques can inflame social consequences that can linger. Ebola, for instance, has already fractured ancient village practices of greetings, family affection, and burial rites. It has stigmatized whole nations and people out of misguided fear. During the AIDS-HIV crisis, gay men were banned from giving blood, fearing a contamination of the blood supply. Now a Health and Human Services Committee has voted to revise the 31-year ban and institute a one-year deferral period to mean that men who have had sex with other men within the past 12 months would not be permitted to give blood. The recommendation goes before a Food and Drug Administration advisory panel tomorrow for an eventual vote. Jason Cianciato is director of public policy at the Gay Men's Health Crisis and HIV/AIDS Service Organization based here in New York. Welcome, Jason.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So what do you think was the original motive of this ban? And can you set it in the context of there was a frenzy surrounding AIDS in the 1980s, that's for sure, in terms of misguided fears all over the place.
In the early 1980s, when the ban was put in place, very little was known about HIV. And there were a large number of people who require blood products to stay alive, including people living with hemophilia, who contracted HIV through tainted blood, including Ryan White, the young man for whom the Ryan White Care Act is named after. And so there was good reason for there to be caution and concern. But as you pointed out, that's been over 30 years ago. We know a tremendous more about HIV, and we have technology that can detect HIV in blood within 10 days of transmission. So this policy is outdated and needs to be changed.
So I'm guessing you're in your 30s.
I will be 40 in 6 months.
All right. I guessed right. Describe the time that you first tried to give blood, and it was well after we knew all of the things that you've just described.
Correct. I was 17, and like many high schools and colleges around the nation, we were having a blood drive. And I wanted to be a part of school spirit. I wanted to be a part of doing something good. So I went into my high school gymnasium and filled out some paperwork and sat down in front of a woman. I don't know if she was a nurse or a technician. And we're, you know, going through a number of questions. And then suddenly the question came, have you had sex with another man even just once since 1977? And the question just floored me. I didn't know why she was asking me that. I was in the closet, very afraid of discrimination and harassment and rejection in school and rejection from my family. And, you know, did she know something about me that I didn't know? Why was she asking me this question? What did she mean? Did you ever have sex with another man?
Did you interact with her?
You know, I think that I just was quiet and answered the question and moved on.
But otherwise, you would have had to come out right then and there, probably the biggest decision of your life at that point in your life.
Absolutely.
Just because of a questionnaire.
And, you know, it also raises one of the challenges of the question that makes this process so far so unscientific. At that time in my life, I had yet to participate in any kind of high-risk sexual behavior that would have exposed me to HIV. And it points out the problem inherent to this day, which is that the screening for donors should be based on the risk assessment of their behavior, not on their sexual orientation or gender identity. A focus solely on sexual orientation not only is unscientific in that it allows people to give blood or defers people for shorter periods of time who participate in just as high-risk sexual behavior, but it also reinforces the stigma and discrimination that drives the HIV epidemic in the U.S. You know, when I was that 17-year-old kid, what that experience did was reinforce for me that being gay as an identity was inherently diseased. And the fallacies that I had been taught that being gay was automatically equated with catching HIV and dying were only reinforced. And it's prevailing to this day. And this is a federal policy that reinforces it. And that's why it needs to change.
When should it have changed, do you think? How should these things be handled?
What we're advocating for is a change from a identity-based deferral to a risk-based screening tool. And that's already been happening for over a decade in countries like Italy. which has not seen an increase in transfusion-related HIV transmission since it changed that policy. You know, this 12-month policy that they're going to be debating tomorrow, this is a policy that has been going on in Australia since 2000 for 14 years. And the U.S. is lagging 14 years behind the 12-month deferral policy and just about as long behind a risk-based deferral policy. And for the FDA, what it really comes down to is money. In 2010, when the studies for which we're going to hear data at tomorrow's meeting were put in motion, there was a decision not to fund the study that could create a new donor history questionnaire that would focus on assessing risk of behavior rather than identity. So right then and there, we knew that the chance of switching to this not just ideal but scientifically based policy of risk-based deferral was not going to happen.
Although it's not about money. I mean, it's a paltry sum to fund a study compared to, you know, buying a tank or a fighter jet or something like that. The reasons for not funding that are all political.
Absolutely. But in the age of austerity where we see non-defense discretionary funding cut further and further, it actually is an issue of medical health research. And so, you know, one of the questions that I'm going to be asking the committee tomorrow when I give my testimony is, what is the price of discrimination? What is the price of HIV stigma for the United States and its blood donation policy? Because the decision to not spend the money to do the research necessary to support this change in policy is a decision to continue the message that automatically equates HIV with being gay and bisexual. You know, the CDC recently put out data that showed between 2002 and 2011 a 138% increase in HIV transmission in youth, I believe, ages 13 to 29. What is causing that? Why are young people at such high risk of HIV transmission? And I think policies like this, which carry forward unscientific understanding of what it is that makes you catch HIV, which carries forward these discriminatory notions of what it means to be gay in the United States, like what I experienced way back when I was 17, is part of the problem.
You describe yourself as low risk.
Correct. My husband and I have been together for 11 years, married for 7. We have a monogamous relationship. Yet under the current policy, we're banned for life. But someone who identifies as heterosexual and says in responding to the donor history questionnaire that they've had sex with someone who's HIV positive is deferred for 12 months.
Jason Cianciato is Director of Public Policy at Gay Men's Health Crisis, an HIV AIDS service organization based right here in New York City. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you.